You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 26th of January. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by producer Hannah. How's it going?
Hello.
Good.
Yeah, we've made it to the show.
We have. We've had a little bit of a rush to the end, people getting back to us right at the last minute sort of moment. So we've been working real hard right up to the wire, which is a, you know, an apt phrase for our show anyway. So it's good. We've got some great stories coming up for you on the show today. So School Strike for Climate New Zealand is holding a rally outside Parliament today to call on the government to meet 6 demands and take climate action in the first 100 days of government. I speak to one of their representatives about this. Hannah spoke to Bernie Smith, who is the CEO of the Monte Cecilia Housing Trust, about Labor's recently announced plan to build public housing and about the situation on the ground. I also spoke to Dr. Bridget Toy Cronin, who is a director and senior lecturer at the University of Otago Faculty of Law, about her report on how we can combat the gap in access to justice in Aotearoa using online tools. Hannah spoke to the Disarmament and Security Centre Coordinator Lucy Stewart about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which became international law today. And then finally, I go over the latest regarding the new COVID case. He aho o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tuku pātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395, or Waimairana, you can give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, kowe e wareware e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō he pakihiri rokiroki, mārunga i te pae tukutuku o irarangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. So if you want to go over anything that was in the show today, you can always hit us up there and see what was covered on the show. Also, if you miss a show, you can always head over there too and see what we've been up to. You can also follow us on our social medias, which are 95BFM News on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, if you want to catch up with what's been going on The Wire during the week, and also on other topical issues that we may be covering or events that we may be at in the future. But anyway, let's crack in to the first piece. So today at 12:30, there is a strike going outside Parliament held by School Strike for Climate New Zealand. I spoke to Ethan Reel, the media representative for School Strike for Climate New Zealand, about the rally today and what the organisation's 100 Days for Action demands are. There's a rally taking place today outside Parliament as part of School Strike for Climate's 100 Days for Action campaign. Could you explain what this rally and the campaign is all about?
Yeah, definitely. So basically this campaign is us utilising our movement and acknowledging that the Labor League government is in an extremely privileged position. You know, in my 16 years of life, there hasn't been a government that's had a type of majority. So our main message to them is they need to use this to their advantage for the next 3 years and commit to taking climate action. Part of our campaign was collating a list of demands from ourselves and the people of Aotearoa. So our other main message sending to the government today is we're at the footsteps of your workplace, so please listen to us. Please act on the demands that all of us are calling for. Because you're never going to get another opportunity like this. They're in an extremely privileged position and they need to use it wisely.
Fantastic. Now, could you go over these demands? I understand there's 6 of them. Is that correct?
So, we want to prohibit the implementation of and phase out the use of fossil fuels nationwide. Number 2 is investing in a 100% renewable energy economy nationwide as well. Number three, we've got investing in a just transition. So obviously looking at the retraining and upskilling of workers that are currently in sustainable industries and supporting them financially and physically, not leaving any Kiwi behind in that transition. Number four, we demand that the government honours its responsibility to our Pacific Island neighbours. And then number five, we've got investing and reducing our agricultural emissions. Obviously, with them being the largest emitters we've got in the industry, we definitely want to have a key focus on that and promoting sustainable methods of farming, such as regenerative farming, and looking at cleaner practices. And lucky last, the one that we're pushing for the most, is investing in climate education. So we want the government to be able to provide the basic foundations of science behind climate change, as well as the economic and social impacts that follow along climate change. So this is going to be looking at implementing compulsory standards throughout years 1 to 10, and also being able to offer them in specific subjects throughout the NCEA courses. And our main message is that we want to be able to offer future generations the basic foundations of climate science, and being able to give them the opportunity, an equal opportunity, to be part of this movement with us. We know that education is everything, and I know that speaking on behalf of the school strike, ourselves personally being in high school, we don't get that basic climate education. We have to teach ourselves about it, and there are so many misguided rumours out there in society. You never know what you're interpreting. So being able to teach the basic and the truthful facts behind climate change is extremely crucial for us.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ethan. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the rally today?
No, basically just please, if anyone's listening to this before the rally, please come by. We'd love to have your support. This movement isn't just distilled down to our organisation. It's an intergenerational movement. We need everyone's support because at the end of the day, that's what's going to get the government to take on action. We need everyone here.
That was Ethan Real from the School Strike for Climate New Zealand organisation speaking on the rally taking place today between 12:30 and 2 p.m. on the Parliament lawns to demand real, meaningful climate action from our government. We will be right back after a little break. Here is Destroy Me by The Bug featuring Disfig.
Burning fingers, temples dripping. Summer on Queen's Wharf is back for 2021 with a series of free events and activities in the heart of the waterfront. This Wednesday, get stretchy and take in the ocean air with sunrise yoga from 7 a.m. Then on Thursday, enjoy an evening of creativity next to the sea with Drawing Club, a relaxed life drawing session for all skill levels of 5 to 7 p.m. Visit the Queen's Wharf Facebook page for more info and to reserve your free tickets. Summer on Queen's Wharf is made possible by Pānuku Development Auckland with help from the lovelies at Social Ritual.
No candlelit dinners, no commercial mush. Celebrate Anti-Valentine's Day at MOTAT with fun, dancing, karaoke, live music, the Love Police, and all sorts of antics. MOTAT Anti-Valentine's, Saturday, February 13, 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets just $20 or $15 for students from motat.nz. R18.
Why is a dog like a tree?
It's 5:45. Go back to bed.
Because both of their barks are rough. Hey!
I don't even have work today. Why am I awake?
Waking up with laughter makes your whole day nice.
I'm not laughing.
You'll get it in a minute.
Morning's a no joke. Start your day on the right foot with the 95BFM Wake Up Call. A smooth tune lovingly selected by Rachel herself every weekday on breakfast. The 95BFM Wake Up Call. Thanks to Espresso Workshop.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire. Marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Kia ora, you're tuned into The Wire with Jemima and Hannah on 95BFM. Here is Hannah with her first piece.
The Labor government announced last week that it intends to build 18,000 state homes by the end of 2024, which would bring our total public housing stock up to 81,000. This is the first of a series of upcoming housing policy announcements that have been signalled, including reforming the Resource Management Act and initiatives to support first home buyers. These measures are expected to largely focus on the supply side of the housing crisis, as measures that would address demand, like a capital gains tax, have been categorically ruled out by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Pressure is mounting for the government to address the ongoing housing crisis, which over the last year has spiralled even further. Figures from the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand show house prices across the country have increased by 17% over the last year. Even when Auckland has been taken out of the equation, the rise remains steep. Doubt has also been cast against the public housing build that was announced, particularly that 18,000 new state homes across 4 years are inadequate when the state housing waitlist has ballooned to a record 22,000 today. Community housing groups have been among those voicing their disappointment at this policy, the Monte Cecilia Housing Trust being one. I spoke to their CEO, Bernie Smith, about the issue, and I started by asking him what the situation on the ground was like.
Well, on the ground, with our headquarters being in South Auckland, I would dare to suggest we're in the epicentre of homelessness and poverty. So we're getting 20 to 30 calls per day from families who are seeking a housing solution. 12 months ago, we were getting 10 to 15 calls a week. So sadly now, we've got about 400 families on our wait list, whereas we would normally only have 10 or 20 families on our wait list.
So Labor recently announced a new public housing policy. Could you give a little overview of what it is?
Yeah, well, the public housing plan is certainly pointing us as a country in the right direction in the sense of the government's commitment to its supply of further housing. And more than any other government, it is building more houses. So from that perspective, it's really positive. It's really positive around the acknowledgement of a real commitment to work with iwi and Māori and have more place-based and mahi approaches, which are bespoke particularly to and for Māori. So for Māori, by Māori is a way of really wanting to make a difference for one of our most deprived communities in this country.
Do you think it goes far enough? How effective do you think it will be?
Look, I think another positive in this plan is that it's very regionalised in its focus, and it really needs to be, because there's a real urban drift out of cities back into communities. So it's really positive in the sense of these areas that are under rent stress, housing stress. From my perspective, it doesn't go far enough in the sense of numbers, because the wait list is actually growing faster than we've ever seen before, with it now up at 22,000 plus. And sadly, the wait register is actually growing faster than the build program.
This is the biggest public housing building program since the 70s, but like you said, the numbers that are planned do not match the waiting lists as they are currently. Does this point towards action needing to be taken to address private housing, not just public?
Look, I've always maintained and believed and publicly spoken about the need for a 2025-year housing plan that would be adopted across political parties. Because what we're seeing at the moment is a huge amount of money being poured into homelessness in the sense of emergency housing, transitional housing and their supportive programs. There's real emphasis by this government as well for first home ownership. But what's really missing is the affordable rentals right in the middle of that housing continuum. And families that once were able to afford a housing option are now being tipped into homelessness and poverty.
So the Prime Minister has said that she does not believe that house prices should fall, but rather that they should be increasing less steeply. Is it possible to stem the housing crisis with an incrementalist approach like this?
I think that's a very interesting statement, because in South Auckland, where our headquarters is in Māngere, the average rent is around $550 to $650 per week. The average income is $55,000 to $65,000 per household. So if you pay that rent as a household, you're only left with $60 per week to spend on food, petrol, and other power, water, which creates a dependency on government further subsidising the family through benefits to be able to survive on a day-to-day basis. So there really needs to be a reduction or a holding pattern of rent increases. We cannot continue to have the rent increases at the pace that we're having, at any level, in my opinion.
And of course, waiting for house prices to stop increasing rather than taking a stance that they should be reduced means that any changes in house prices that incur will happen over decades. So from your experience working with Monte Cecilie Housing Trust, can families actually afford to wait decades?
No, they can't. And the information I have at hand with our 400, 500 families that we are assisting with housing solutions at the moment, 30% of their income represents around $140 to $170 per week. And basically that creates or sets a benchmark of what an affordable rental should be. And yet we know in Auckland you're very lucky to get anything under $600. And so to wait for years and decades is totally unacceptable, because what is happening is that the poverty and homelessness is increasing at such a substantive rate that it's costing the taxpayers more every day to support these families. So we need to have a housing strategy that looks at the whole housing continuum and implement it immediately to create some continuity in the sense of future planning for builders, for developers, for supply line, hopefully bringing, not bringing rent down, but stabilising it, because I don't think we can bring rent down without actually creating a GFC bust, and that impacts the whole community. So somehow or other we need to subdue it.
What types of policies or what approach to housing policy would you like to see instead?
Well, I think the first thing I would like to see is that the government move away from the belief that the government has to be all things to all people and can resolve it. We know that it takes a community to raise a child, and I would dare to suggest that there's 70-odd community housing providers across the country that have got shovel-ready projects in the sense of houses ready to build, but they need some assistance from the government or from other sources to be able to put the spade in the ground to commence that building program. The RMA, there's a whole lot of levers that the government needs to pull at the same time, not just one lever with an expectation that they're going to build their way out of the crisis that we're in. But above all, I think a housing strategy, so we can all determine what the direction is, and it's cross-party, so we don't get one group building and another group selling, but as a whole country, we're actually committed to making a difference and ensuring, as is a human right, a house that is safe, warm, secure and sustainable for every family in New Zealand.
That was Bernie Smith, CEO of the Monte Cecilia Housing Trust, speaking about housing policy and the housing crisis.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Many New Zealanders struggle gaining access to legal assistance due to the limits in applying for legal aid and the expense of hiring a lawyer. The University of Otago has released a report on how effective online self-help tools could bridge the access to justice gap. I spoke to report author Dr. Bridget Toy Cronin, who is a director and senior lecturer at the University of Otago Faculty of Law, about how online tools can assist people seeking legal information. We also discuss the reality of simplifying the vast amount of legal information and precedents that are out there for people to access. I began by asking Bridget to begin by speaking to the gap in access to justice in Aotearoa and why it exists.
So we call the justice gap, it describes the, also called the missing majority. So it's most people, because most people don't qualify for legal aid, which is state a state loan to pay for legal services, and they can't afford to pay the hourly rates. Most lawyers charge on an hourly rate for a lawyer, which start around $200 and something and go upwards from there. So it can be very expensive to get legal assistance. And so the justice gap is everyone who sits in that gap between legal aid and affording private legal services.
Is this something that has existed for some time, and has there not really been anything done to address it, I suppose?
Well, so the justice gap has existed for some time, and there have been lots of efforts to try and address it, but we certainly haven't solved the problem. And it's probable that it's growing because, you know, like all inequality in our society, this is just another expression of inequality, because you know, as the gap between the people who have something and do not have something grows, you've got this growing bunch of people in the middle. So that's possibly some of the explanation, but it's a phenomenon that we see all over the OECD, basically, that there are people sitting in this gap, and some of it's to do with the structure of legal services. Legal services have got more and more expensive, and as a result, fewer and fewer people can afford them. So we don't think that there's one solution. It's quite a complex problem with lots of different dimensions to it. But one of the things that we see as an important part of the toolkit is thinking about how can we harness online technology to try and help close that gap for people.
Now, what is this online technology and what do these tools look like in practice?
So it starts from anything from like long form written text online, which is your most basic form of legal information, through to much more sophisticated tools that can guide users through a questionnaire and then create a letter at the end, which they can then send to the person they're in a dispute with, things like that. So what we have at the moment in New Zealand is some great online long form legal information. So if you Google a legal problem, you'll find that there is information provided by the government, by organisations like Citizens Advice and Community Law. The difficulty is that you'll probably have to wade through a lot of long form text, and it's quite hard to figure out whether that applies to your situation. You know, these are often stressful situations for people, so that makes it even more difficult. And so that what we're looking at is how can we push New Zealand on, how can we get Aotearoa to a position where people can go online and have much more flexible tools that help go through information, tell them stuff that's relevant to their situation, and also help them to take action. Because, you know, if you just get information, that's great, but you really need to know what the next step is. What do I do next and how do I do it?
You just mentioned that a lot of that information is really long form, and depending on what your situation is, there are a number of different avenues and different precedents set by different cases to sort of wade through. How easy is it to simplify something down for somebody to read and use as a tool to find out what that next step they need to take is when they are looking at facing a dispute with someone without legal assistance?
So it's not particularly easy because, as you pointed out, you know, like the law shifts and there's a lot of different facts which might change your particular situation and therefore the legal outcome. But it is possible to do for quite a few common problems. You know, there are people tend to experience similar kinds of problems. You know, there's a huge range, but you'll get statistical blips where you've got, for example, consumer problems, tenancy problems, employment problems. They're kind of the big ones that people tend to experience. And so what other jurisdictions have done, so internationally, is that they've coordinated the efforts of their various state and non-state agencies together to try and create tools. So what we're pushing for is that, because Aotearoa is, you know, relatively small and we've just one jurisdiction, we don't have that complication that other countries have with, you know, having different state laws and things, we think it could be done for our country quite well. And what we want to see is everyone kind of working together and pooling their resources and their information to create these sort of higher level tools to help people. And we think, based on the international experience, that if we go with a really cooperative, collaborative approach, we'll be able to pull off something quite good.
You're talking about a collaborative approach. Does that mean with assistance from sort of the private legal sector? Is this something that the private legal sector is on board with if, you know, obviously they want to get paid at the end of the day, and if more people are looking at sorting out their disputes themselves, is this something that potentially the private legal sector is not overly interested in?
Well, I think the private legal sector is kind of a bit of a generalisation because it takes everything from sort of high-end corporate law down to, you know, sole practitioners working, you know, with low-income clients. So I think part of the private legal sector is probably pretty disinterested in it because it's not the kind of clients they service. You know, we're not talking about corporates. So they won't really mind what's going on over in this sector. And then you've got a lot of lawyers who are actually really concerned about this. It's quite dispiriting being part of a profession, especially if you joined it for sort of social justice reasons, to see people not being able to access services. So we've got, you know, we know of a lot of lawyers who are really keen to help in these efforts, and we're getting lawyers coming through now who have got, you know, a double degree in computer science or something, and they're really good at programming, and they actually are volunteering and wanting to help. So there is a kind of entrepreneurial social justice warrior type lawyer class coming through who are keen to help with this sort of thing. And yeah, there might be some lawyers who are less keen on the idea, but I think by and large, lawyers are keen to see this problem solved, because it's actually bad for the profession as well as for clients.
And just finally, how do we get there? How do we make sure that these online services and these tools exist? What are the steps to get there?
Yeah, so we think that the best way forward is basically to pull the different people who are already working in this space together. And we've made some efforts in that direction. We've run a couple of national fora to, you know, bring everyone together to discuss. And we think that that needs to now go on to a next stage of making kind of a formal plan. In other jurisdictions like Canada, they've created some amazing cross-jurisdictional portals and things by having everyone kind of sign up to the same vision and then work towards it. So we see that as what we're hoping to see come out of 2021.
That was Dr. Bridget Toy-Cronin, who is a director and senior lecturer at the University of Otago Faculty of Law, speaking on how online tools and self-help tools can assist people seeking legal information and also assist in bridging the gap in access to justice.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons comes into force today, becoming international law. New Zealand played a prominent role in drafting this treaty, with local disarmament ambassador H.E. Del Higgy acting as vice president of the 2017 United Nations Negotiating Conference. Carrying on, Aotearoa's pretty proud nuclear-free history. While we're no longer living in the area of duck and cover drills, nuclear weapons still exist, and nuclear weapons existing means that they have the capacity to do incredible damage, even if the sort of real politic that exists right now means that such a scenario is less likely than it was during, say, the Cold War. I spoke to Lucy Stewart, coordinator at the Disarmament and Security Centre in Christchurch, about the treaty, what it will do, and how effective it will be. We also talked about why denuclearization has faded as a political issue. I started by asking her for an overview of the treaty.
So the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty just went into force on Friday, January 22nd. And so this was negotiated at the United Nations in 2017. And it was adopted by over 120 nations there at the UN. Now, it's taken 3 years to come into force because there's a, you know, ratification process that states have to go through. And once 50 countries had ratified it, then that 90 days after that, the treaty goes into force. So the 50th country ratified it in November. And now, yeah, really exciting that it's now gone into force. There's also another 36 countries that have signed up to the treaty, meaning they are now working towards the ratification process. So within hopefully a few months, a year, more and more countries will come on board. And so basically a vast majority of the world's nation states have said, yeah, enough is enough with nuclear weapons. They should be illegal. They should be banned. And we're taking steps to make that happen.
Is the focus of the treaty on disarmament or just preventing further proliferation of nukes?
It's both. So definitely disarmament, because in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a 1968 treaty, which is kind of the cornerstone of nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, this sort of recognises that there are some nuclear weapon states in the world, and the vast majority of the world's countries have signed up to this treaty. But in Article 6 of that treaty, it says that there is an obligation for those nuclear weapon states to move towards disarmament and disarm. But this treaty is now over 50 years old, and those countries have not fulfilled their side of the bargain. So the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty basically builds on the Non-Proliferation Treaty to say actually these weapons are illegal and therefore those countries should disarm. So, yeah, it is about disarmament, and there are pathways within the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty for nuclear weapon states to join and then disarm, or disarm and then join. And it's also about non-proliferation too, just to really set this norm that actually these weapons are illegal, they're banned under international law, and no one should have them. And so if you look at other weapons bans, so for cluster munitions or landmines, chemical weapons, for example, they create a really strong stigma and norm against those weapons so that no nation states will want to use them. If you look at landmines, for example, the US, I believe, still hasn't actually signed it, but then, and cluster munitions too, but countries don't, even if they don't sign the treaty, they become more and more less likely to use those weapons because their allies put pressure on them, no one wants to kind of collaborate in missions with them if they're going to use those weapons, and so they over time they become kind of defunct and unusable. And so this is the same process with nuclear weapons now, that we build this norm and the stigma against the weapons, and it becomes harder and harder for them to be produced. Countries who have them, it really becomes politically awkward for them, and big divestment campaigns happen, so banks and investment companies don't want to finance them anymore, and we kind of draw the power out of that industry.
Do you have any concerns about compliance, or are those sort of soft power mechanisms that you've just elaborated about, do you think that those will be enough?
Well, at the moment, no, I don't have concerns about compliance, because there are really stringent reports and things that countries have to submit, and it will have exactly the same compliance that the Non-Proliferation Treaty regime has with the IAEA. And at the moment with the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the countries that have signed are obviously non-nuclear weapon states, so there's no issues with compliance. So New Zealand, for example, will submit a report. It will become a little bit more, detail. No, the detail won't change, but when nuclear weapon states and nuclear weapon allied states join, but there are pathways for that. And the first meeting of states parties for the treaty will happen this year, and that's when they will figure out the nuts and bolts of that. But yeah, I have no concerns about compliance.
Disarmament isn't as prominent in public discourse as it was a few decades ago, but obviously mm-hmm. nuclear weapons still exist and are still capable of exerting the same threat as they were before. Why do you think it's faded as an issue?
Okay, so I think it's two-pronged here. For example, in New Zealand, we've been nuclear-free for over 30 years. And so I think, the earlier generation... other generations have been really concerned about nuclear weapons because they've seen the testing in the Pacific and they understand the consequences, whereas I think younger generations here, they kind of see it as past history without actually realising that the threat today is even greater than it was, in the 70s and 80s. So I think that's one issue here in New Zealand, and the organisation I work for, the Disarmament and Security Centre, that's one of the big things that we do is work on public education and education at the tertiary level so that young people actually understand what's going on, what they're kind of inheriting, and the work that still needs to be done. Globally, I think, that's the same issue globally as well. I think there's all sorts of different issues. Things like climate change, which are really important issues, have also taken, a centre stage, I think, with kind of young people's movements. So it's partly, I think public education globally, actually, and bringing awareness back to disarmament. And I think, we just had to look at the news a couple of years ago with Trump and Kim Jong-un and North Korea to see that actually these threats haven't gone away. They may not play out as regularly as they did, say, in the Cold War, but actually they're really real and they are there, and we need to tackle them.
That was Disarmament and Security Centre Coordinator Lucy Stewart speaking about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and disarmament more generally.
Thank you so much, Hannah. We will be right back after a little break.
Nothing says summer like the smell of sunscreen, a picnic on the beach, crisp salad, succulent dip, and the best organic sourdough either side of the Bombays. Bread and Butter make real sourdough, supporting organic practices with New Zealand-grown grains and the best locally supplied ingredients. Bread and Butter, for bread that's better. Three stores across Auckland, Grayland, Milford and Ponsonby. And coming soon to the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Welcome to Games Dungeon. How may I help you?
Just after a B card.
Shiny or standard?
Just how it comes.
I'm not seeing it in my Magic the Gathering Price Companion.
I think it's just digital.
Digimon. If you want kid stuff, try the Collector's Emporium.
There's only one place to get a B-card. Win-win-win sick prizes, get incredible discounts and help us stay Auckland's best radio station since forever. Uh-huh. Sign up for a B-card from just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/signup. Perfect.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. For our last piece today, I wanted to look at the recent COVID case found in the community, and I wanted to go over some of the issues that have been brought up by the media as we wait for more information from the government and the Ministry of Health. I spoke to Leslie Gray, a public health specialist and senior lecturer at the University of Otago based in Wellington. However, the audio quality was not the best, and unfortunately I can't play the interview because it's just way too hard to understand, but I have transcribed the interview, and so me and Hannah are going to read it because it is really interesting and definitely relevant and important for us Aucklanders, particularly up here, and also for New Zealanders right across the country to just be aware of what is going on with the new community case. So I'm just going to read back and forth. I'm me and Hannah is Leslie. Just bear with. Unfortunately, it's not exactly the way I wanted it to be, but it'll be just fine. You get all the information anyway. So to begin with the new COVID community case, multiple close contacts have returned negative results, and the case also returned negative results before leaving isolation. How does the incubation period for COVID-19 work? Can these close contacts return positive results later on?
We know that there is usually up to about a 14-day incubation period, which is why the people in managed isolation and quarantine have a test at day 3 and day 10. Now, actually, with these contacts of this woman, the time that they were tested, they were already at or beyond day 5. So they were at the point where it would be suitable to have the first test.
It was reported yesterday that genome testing has shown the case is from the new South African variant. Does this variant pose a greater risk of an outbreak than previous community cases?
So far, we understand that the South African variant, which is also known as number... The South African variant seems to be more transmissible than the variant that we had in August last year. So it is believed that it can transmit and infect more people. If there is a person that's infected with it, they can infect more people.
There have also been reports discussing the possibility for the virus to travel through air vents in quarantine facilities. Is it likely that this is how the recent community case was transmitted?
Back in August, we were concerned about how the virus was transmitted in shared spaces like lifts and surfaces people have touched. Back then, my colleagues like Michael Baker were wondering if it could be related to ventilation systems. We know that there are lots of viruses that can be transmitted by ventilation, like Legionnaire's disease. Airborne seems to be a particular route for this virus, and there have been questions asked about the ventilation systems in hotels, because unlike hospitals, they do not have to have one-way ventilation systems, and we know that other viruses can be transmitted through these systems.
Does this consideration of ventilation systems have anything to do with the increased transmissibility of the South African variant that this case involves, rather than previous transmission cases of different variants?
When a virus is transmitted through the air, then you have got to consider where your sources are. Last year, in the early days, we were talking about people sneezing and rapid transmission of airborne infections, when in fact we know that just breathing and being in close proximity can transmit COVID. So yes, ventilation systems could be a contributing factor in some of these cases.
Finally, for a number of New Zealanders, the idea of going back into lockdown is a scary thought, particularly when we look at what is happening overseas. How likely is it that New Zealand will face another lockdown this year?
It is important to say that we are so lucky here in Aotearoa. And for most of us, let's not spoil that. We can do a lot of things to keep these things locally. There are a lot of things we can do to minimise risk and avoid another lockdown. What could potentially happen at some point is that we don't know someone is out in the community actively transmitting one of these viruses. We've seen in August in Auckland how this can spread quickly. So, with these new variants, it is possible that if you have someone that is a quick transmitter, some people do, some people don't, it's possible we could have a bigger outbreak. So if there was a case where we were unsure of the origin, there would likely be a quicker lockdown because we don't want to see what is happening in the UK happen here.
And so if people are not feeling well and they think that they have symptoms of COVID-19, what should they do?
If anyone develops any symptoms, a worsening cough, fever of at least 38 degrees, shortness of breath and temporary loss of smell, go to your family GP and call ahead first, or go to the Auckland District Health Board website and check where your local testing centres are.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Hannah. I'm sorry that was a little bit random, but, you know, obviously rather relevant at the moment. But anyway.
That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to everyone who spoke with us for the show today. Thank you very much, Hannah, for being a wonderful producer as always. And thank you to you for listening and texting in. We love hearing from you and we love that you're out there listening. Hope that you have a wonderful day out there. I know I was hoping it would be sunshine, but it's not really looking like it is, which is a little sad. But, you know, it's nice and warm, which is good. Up next is Jin with the 1-4. See you later.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.